Yunpeng, could you please say a little more about using the contemplation of death to gladden the mind? Well, I think one of the things in terms of, oftentimes when we think of gladdening the mind, is sort of like things that kind of make the mind happy or make the mind feel gratified in some way. But I think what contemplation of death helps to, I mean, it gladdens the mind in the sense that one, it's sort of like cutting to the chase. You know, it's cut out all the extraneous stuff that seems to clutter and complicate the mind, clutter our lives, and it really helps us to keep on track, keep on point, not get distracted. It really sorts out what's actually really important and what's not. And it's not a, I've said when I was talking this morning, it's kind of counterintuitive, but it gladdens the mind in the sense that, all right, I really do want to, I don't want to get lost here. I don't want to get sidetracked. Really want to keep my mind on what's really important, what's really beneficial, what's actually going to bring well-being into my life and to others, so that, that it's not getting one isn't losing the plot, so to speak. Also, there's a PS, so feel free to share with the group that my 15-year-old organized a walkout from her high school. Several hundred young people walked out of school at the same time all over our city, met up to peacefully protest the election results. I have a lot of faith in her and her generation. They'll be voting in 2020. So, how do I become a more generous person if there is a constant underlying worry about having enough? Money for living, retirement, etc. How to create a sense of abundance within so I can freely give to others? Well, I think that's one of the really important things to be looking at, is the constant underlying worry about not having enough. Because and it's not that it's not real and we shouldn't pay attention to it, but there is a, you know, like the whole economy of, say, Western countries functions quite happily on a perception of lack. Everything is built on not having enough. So you have to have more in order to be happy, to be comfortable, to be secure, to be safe. And the Buddha builds a very different economy. He builds an economy of gifts, an economy of giving. And when we live from that place of giving and sharing, then we create networks of community. We build networks of human connection, and that's oftentimes what's missing in that constant drive to have enough. Because we're focused on things usually, and that keeps us from really experiencing a sense of abundance. I remember really clearly. I remember earlier in the retreat I was talking about a lay person who Ajahn Chah taught how to be a village doctor, and he was one of the regulars at Wat Nanachat, and was kind of one of the linchpins of establishing the monastery in the early days. So he'd come pretty much every day and help out at the monastery, in the setting up of the monastery, and helping out, making sure everything was done. And remember one time we were sitting around doing some work or something. We were just sitting and talking to him. I remember him sitting and he's carving something or other. And we're talking, there was a few of us. And he said, you know, I don't have any money, but I'm not poor. And because that's how he lived his life, giving. And like as a village doctor, you don't actually charge for anything. You go and treat people, look after people, and then if those people have things to share, to give, then they will give to that person, and that's how that person lives. And that sense of abundance is an inner quality, because especially in those days, northeast of Thailand was very poor, so on a material level, but people were always shared, and they learn it from the time they're little kids. Remember one of the being struck by that, oftentimes when there'd be a death or a house blessing or something, the monks would be invited to do chanting, have a meal or whatever, and the villagers would always want to give you something special to drink, so especially in the afternoon, so it'd be like a cold Pepsi. And that was a big deal. So you get a bottle of Pepsi. And they'd always drink a little bit. And we tend to do that. We'd drink a little bit and then give it to the kids, or give it to the adult. And everybody would share. It wasn't sort of like the adults sort of you have to share. And it's something you learn from the time you're really little, and you see that example around you all the time of people always sharing, always giving, always helping, and that's just a part of village life. And it's and they didn't have much money, but they weren't poor. And because so much of being poor, I mean, there are obviously some circumstances where you really are struggling, but that sense of also poor is also a state of mind. And most, say, of us in a Western culture, we've got a lot. Again, because I've lived in very simple circumstances, and you realize you don't actually need very much. Mm-hmm. Just human life is actually not that complicated. I find when the mind settles, it is highly suggestible, and the gentlest whisper, be it the or sukha, will bring, in brackets, sometimes, those, if they haven't arisen on their own. You spoke a little last night about sustaining and expanding be it the and rapture, and moving the mind towards equanimity. If you could expand or reiterate, that might be helpful for further exploration. Thank you. Well, I think one of the things that equanimity is a evenness of mind. like an evenness, a steadiness of mind, so that, say, something like joy, quite exciting, even sukha, happiness, is really pleasurable, but there's a movement of kind of a pleasure that's moving. It's what pleasure does. But say equanimity, and it's important to recognize that it's not indifference. It's not not feeling anything, but it's a steadiness, a stillness, a firmness, a being even. But it always has to be supported by mindfulness, and that's the mind becomes extremely sharp and able to discern things clearly when it is still and steady and alert and present. So those are the qualities we want to be trying to, again, the mind is suggestible, and we can encourage the mind to move in that direction. We can plant those seeds and see where it goes. And that, say, as opposed to sort of clamping down, oh, I've got to be equanimous, you know, I got to get my equanimity. It's an encouraging and inclining the mind in that direction, because that's where the greatest clarity lies, and that's the, you know, it's exceptionally powerful tool for insight and understanding things clearly. Is realization of anatta a sudden event, or does it happen gradually with the sense of self becoming less and less dense until eventually it dissolves? I would say it's both, you know, in the sense that, you know, as one reflects and understands it on a sort of logical basis, this makes sense, and it sort of wears away, and it kind of dissolves a bit here, dissolves a bit there. We're able to put it down, doesn't sort of impinge. But then, you know, there's times when it's just bang, it really hits one really, really clearly, but it isn't as if it's sort of a one-shot deal. That the nature of self is it starts creeping in again, and it was quite comfortable and happy being the lord of its domain. so there's sometimes these quite sudden insights, and then, you know, this gradual sort of wearing away, dissolving, and then at some point it becomes very clear. Oh, I can put it down. Or it is put down. Insight is there. Okay. Can you please give some guidance on recognizing delusion in the mind? Greed and aversion seem easier to spot. Thank you for your great generosity and compassion in answering questions so clearly and directly. I remember Ajahn Chah being asked this one time by there was a few people. Jack Kornfield brought a group of people when it was after Ajahn Chah's. It wasn't at the monastery. It was in Bangkok, and Jack was passing through. A few of fellow practitioners were with him, and came and paid respects, and it had been after Ajahn Chah had his had his operation. And but anyway, the question was asked, and Ajahn Chah sort of said, "Well," he said, "it's kind of like riding on a horse, and you know, sort of riding along. Where's the horse? Where's the horse?" Instead, it's like delusions sort of carrying us along, and we don't see it. Sort of. So that willingness to look and think, it's the delusion in the mind that keeps us from not seeing clearly. That usually, I mean, one of the ways of recognizing a delusion is just the feeling of uncertainty, a feeling of wavering in the mind, a feeling of anxiety or fear. Those are, and you really tap into that and see it, because that's how delusion manifests itself. And especially around that, the sense of me, the sense of I. Because it's delusion that builds that construct of a self, self-perception, self-view, self-identity. So recognizing its manifestation, because just sort of looking directly there's delusion. Because it's easy to say, oh yeah, that's anger. That's aversion. That's really clear. And as I said, like desire. But we have to see the signs of delusion more than the actual delusion itself, because that gets to root. We're able to track it back that way. Can you suggest some ways of approaching walking meditation that you have found fruitful? Do the themes and frames of Anapanasati apply, for example? Is this an adaptable, useful structure? Okay. Yeah, actually I haven't talked at all about, or hardly anything at all, about walking meditation this retreat. Especially for the forest tradition, Ajahn Chah, the walking meditation, you know, forms a pretty large part of the practice. Oftentimes, it's fairly evenly balanced. Some monastics, some teachers, walking meditation is the primary mode of meditation, and sitting they tend to do it less sometimes. But in terms of approaches, of course the grounding awareness in the body itself, the presence, mindfulness, being rooted in the body, that has being able to pay attention to movement and keep anchoring, in touch, in sensation, the general feeling of the body that's really helpful. And one of the things that, like, bringing awareness and attention kind of down lower. I mean, our minds tend to go up into thought, into conjecture, into speculation. So that bringing awareness and attention back down into the sensation of touch, feet. There's an anchoring that's quite natural there. Sometimes if one uses and one can definitely use that structure of the mindfulness of breathing, both in terms of, say, using the breath while one is walking, which would mean walking a bit slower so that the breath becomes more, and so that and one can walk, you know, quite slow. And let that the breath be kind of a primary object. So I've sometimes done walking meditation where it's like breathing in, lifting the foot, and breathing out, setting the foot down. So that becomes quite a slow walk, and the breath is the the anchor or the driver of the walking then, and then then one can use that whole Anapanasati structure to do that. Oftentimes I haven't really pursued it that much in terms of the whole structure, but you know, there's no reason why one couldn't. But certainly as using the breath really the focus of the mind, the mind settling, and the attention becoming very steady, and walking in conjunction with the breath, I found very the stability of the mind gets, the mind gets very sharp very quickly. Walking and using say a mantra, very common in Thailand, in the sense like that, the forest tradition using the Buddho practice, so that. So one step, Buddho, so that one's using that the mantra, using a phrase, and then it's tethered to the sensation of walking, and it helps to keep the mind from getting dispersed and getting discursive. There's quite a few different ways of approaching and using techniques in conjunction with the walking. Okay, generally, is right intention a subset of kamma, or is it the whole enchilada? The thing is like when the Buddha says kamma is volition, then, of course, that's a mental event. And then kamma is usually just divided in terms of, say, its base, in the sense, so that bodily kamma, verbal kamma, mental kamma. And right intention, that's like volition, in Pali, or intention is jetana in that use. And then like right intention in the Eightfold Path, is slightly different in the sense that it's samma sankappa, so it's like right mental formations. So it's so it's more like a mental act that's a part of karma. Of course, it's all driven from that movement of mind, that mental formation. It's kind of, in the end, say, all of our volitions, intentions, are the things that drive, say, drive the whole enchilada. Does all the chanting we are doing go back to the Buddha's time, or has some of it evolved later? Some of it goes back to the Buddha's time. The chant on the highest blessings is a discourse from one of the very early collections of the Buddha's teachings. The five subjects for frequent recollection, that's straight from a sutta. We chanted one night, we chanted the Anapanasati Sutta. We chanted some of the others go back. But the general morning and evening chanting that we do is something that is parts, say, like in the evening chanting, there's a recollection of the Buddha, and that's straight from the suttas, that iti biso bhagava, and then it goes on to another one, which is in sort of in chanting in praise of the Buddha, and that was written around the turn of, say, the coming into the 20th century. So maybe 150 years ago, 130 years ago, as written by one of the royal princes who ordained young, was a great scholar, great administrator, ended up being he wrote many educational texts for monastics, and the chanting was sort of came out of that mayu. So that some are after the Buddha's time, but were say like the verses of sharing and aspiration. Those came out of Sri Lanka 1,500 years ago, and were passed down. There's a whole mishmash of stuff that goes all the way back to the Buddha's time, things that are quite ancient, and things that are reasonably modern. Was sati, vedana, jhana part of the religious climate current at the Buddha's time? How revolutionary was he seen to be then? Do we know? I'm not enough of a scholar to really know. There's some things that were unique to the the Buddha's description of a religious path. Certainly, the Four Noble Truths was seen as something quite new. The use of the word khandhas in terms of describing aggregates of beings was a unique to Buddhism. Some things like, say, like sati, vedana, I expect was an ordinary term. Jhana was a fairly ordinary term, I think, in terms of, it has connotations of just like meditate, or to concentrate, to focus. So, he was seen revolutionary in other ways because his teaching was quite unique. It was picked up really quickly, spread very quickly, had opposition to it fairly quickly. In that, some of his teachings on the caste system, that was, and on kind of not following a traditional theocentric, even if it's polytheism, stepped out of a way of teaching a religious path without relying on the traditional gods and deities, but Jeannie would probably know better than me.
His approach to kama was particularly unique.
Oh yeah, yeah. His approach to kama was particularly unique. Yeah, that was really revolutionary. That's really true, because it was that introducing the element of volition being the driving force of kama was hugely revolutionary, because before it was you had to do all these things. So you had to tend a fire, and you had to do ascetic practices, and you had to burn up defilements. And the Buddha said, no, you have to understand your mind. I would like to express my gratitude to your teaching. During these days, I practice following your instructions on the basics of mindfulness of breathing. I have a life issue. I had a life issue before coming here, and it usually comes up in my thoughts during the meditation period from time to time. I've cultivated my mind, associated this issue into my practice, and it's okay. I quite accept the situation and being present with contemplating the mind of my issue. However, when I go back to my normal life, I wish I could use discernment obtained from the meditation practice to solve my issue. I wish I could have a good solution. I was wondering how I include the discernment obtained from lifting up the mind to solve a life issue. I wish I could be more intelligent, brighter, to solve my life problem in a skillful way. Please advise. I think just trusting yourself is really important. You realize you've got to, that's one of the reasons why we step back and do retreats, is that we have an opportunity to see our life more clearly, see our issues more clearly. And sometimes there's a perspective comes in that, oh, that would be useful to apply. And, you know, sometimes it seems really clear when we're sitting in meditation, but then going back into our daily life and with the different things coming all at once. And that's where it's helpful to have a daily practice, that you set time aside for practice. That's also where You know, sometimes, you know, we you know, events and issues might just sweep us away sometimes or seem overwhelming, but then it's important to just give oneself the time to step back. And it might not feel like, you know, why? You know, I remember one person who was a student of Ajahn Chah, a disciple of Ajahn Chah, he moved his family to Bangkok because there was a American Air Force base in Ubon that closed when at the end of the Vietnam War, and so the economy kind of tanked, and he moved his family down. He was a sort of young aspiring businessman, and I remember him talking to me and saying, "You know, I always took Ajahn Chah and the practice with me." And he said, and "I had my shrine room. I always kept the precepts, and every day I would sit at my shrine." He said, "And sometimes it wasn't as if I was meditating or doing anything." Very calm. Sometimes all I could do is sit there and cry and tell my sorrows to Ajahn Chah on my shrine. He said, but I did it every day. I always gave that time to practice. And I think that's a really helpful perspective. Because sometimes they, you know, I've got to try to get my mind peaceful. I've got to be mindful. And, you know, life picks us up and carries us sometimes, but it's important to have that anchor of giving oneself the time to settle, even if it doesn't feel like one's settling very much. Just giving oneself that time on a regular basis really carves that time out and gives an anchor and a perspective for one's life. And it's really, and, you know, just coming on retreat like this is a great opportunity to, you know, so there's perspectives and reflections and ways of contemplating that have been seeded and that one has probably had some insight into oneself, and it's learning how to take that back into the world, into one's life. It's the eighth evening of the retreat. It feels timely to ask, what was Ajahn Chah's teaching for local lay people regarding sexual desire and sexual misconduct? Did he make different emphasis when he taught Westerners? Northeast Thai culture is, it's a village culture, it's farming, it's very down to earth. Also, I just say the there's not a lot of privacy, so sexuality was something ordinary, but it also was really important to have boundaries so that. Sexual misconduct is more around that kind of recognizing the, say, not transgressing they are taking advantage of a situation, overstepping boundaries of established relationships, so and for people living in the world, sexual desire is an ordinary thing, but it's sort of learning boundaries and learning to have a trustworthiness and respect within relationships. It's really that's kind of the essence, and that's how it was always taught. I remember when he came to he taught at IMS like in 1979, and I wasn't there, but I heard the story. And then, of course, there was quite a few questions and circumstances around, say, the precepts of around sexual misconduct and working with sexual desire. And it came up several times, I can't remember exactly how it worked, but anyway, somebody asked him sort of another question, and he sort of poked his finger up his nose and started and didn't say anything, everybody started laughing, and he said, "It's not a big deal." So, it's just that much. Okay. Will you briefly remind me, us, who are the four parents, eight kinds of noble beings? It's in the construct of the one who's on the path to stream entry and one who has realized stream entry, once returner, non-returner, arahant, so path and fruit. So it's four pairs, the path and fruit, and in that realization of the noble path, and so from stream entry to the realization of arahantship. In the teaching on mindfulness of breathing, what does it mean? sets her body erect, having established mindfulness in front of them. I think "in front of" has been interpreted in different ways. Thank you for your teachings and your patience with our questions. There has been a whole lot of different interpretations over time, and part of it is the and there is, I don't think there's a definitive answer. The word is called parimukkam, and mukha is mouth. So then it gets interpreted that one pays attention, establishes mindfulness around the mouth, the tip of the nose, sort of thing around there. But in the Vinaya, then there's different uses of the word mukha, and it doesn't really make sense that it's so limited. So it's sort of so that either and that mukha can mean something a doorway, a front. And so that Ajahn Jeff has treated it quite skillfully in the sense of the bringing mindfulness to the fore. And that's a really skillful way, because in many, many instructions and discourses, you know, the Buddha was often not that specific when it comes to technique, because the reality is that, you know, different things work for different people, and so that. So I think this. I mean, there is a certain controversy over the years, but it's been going on for 2,500 years. So I don't think there's any big resolution that we're going to come to. But I think that that sense of recognizing that the word is used in different ways in different contexts, so that establishing mindfulness in front of one is one way of making it a lot more accessible, a lot more flexible in how we approach the establishing of mindfulness, or bringing mindfulness to the fore is a good way of making it more approachable. The term sati, what does it mean? Does it mean mindfulness? Well, what does mindfulness mean? I mean, you know, in a sense, on a certain level, mindfulness doesn't mean very much at all. It's kind of it's come to have a constellation of meanings in this particular, say, modern era. It was a term that was constructed. I mean, I think I mentioned it a few nights ago that mindfulness was kind of a compound word thought up by one of the very early translators, just using, because steeped in Christian Christian and particularly Anglican concepts of the spiritual practice. So the word sati itself, its root is sa, which is the same root as sanya in the five khandhas. Form, feeling, perception. So that the word sa is its primary meaning is in the constellation of memory. So that what is maybe a more accurate translation of the word sati is recollection. So that one is bringing to mind, recollecting certain themes, certain ways of directing attention, so that it's there's an act of recollecting, bringing to mind, that's happening. So then, and in English, sort of calls it mindfulness. Would you please give some advice on how to deal with obsessive compulsive thoughts that cause fear in the mind and tension in the body? I've tried to remember that mental formations are not self, but this doesn't seem to alleviate the problem or help much. Thank you so much. I mean, just trying to think oneself out of something like that, and we can get, say, obsessively compulsive about thinking about it. So that the I think one of the most skillful ways to deal with thoughts that bring fear or worried, create tension internally, is to ground attention in the body, bring an awareness to the body. Pay attention to where am I tightening, where am I tensing, where am I holding, how can I release this, how can I relax, how can I hold this lightly. And as we bring awareness to the body and relax physically, be more grounded in awareness in the body, then many of the kind of compulsive and restless thoughts or obsessive thoughts will tend to dissipate. It's a natural result of settling. So that using that awareness of the body, having something for it to do other than obsessing about itself, and then having something tangible that one can be just settling, releasing, softening, expanding. There's an ease that starts to settle into the mind itself. Sometimes the mind is. You have to be really careful with the mind. It's so untrustworthy. you have to sort of give it a little bit of space so that you're not getting tangled up too much with it. There's an American writer, Anne Lamott, and her, "My mind's like a bad neighborhood." Yeah, you don't go there alone. Yeah. Okay. Will you tell us a bit of your story in becoming a monk? Early family life, how you came to Thailand, what age you ordained? A bit more than the Abhayagiri website. It's pretty sparse, isn't it? I ordained when I was 24, so grew up in a small town, northern Manitoba, Canada. It's about 600 miles north of the American border. Like if you thought there was nothing in North Dakota, then I'm about 600 miles north of that. you grow up in a small town, and there's probably lots of people here who might have grown up in small towns, and you just can't wait to get out and look for things that able to expand one's scope of what life is. That was a time, as a late 60s, going to university, and so getting exposed to new ideas. And I came across something about Buddhism, and it just grabbed my interest, and I probably tracked down every book on Buddhism in the various libraries, and there weren't that many, and never met any Buddhist teachers, never met any meditation teachers, but I was drawn to Asia, so I ended up in Asia. I was in India. Nothing sort of resonated there with me. And as soon as I got to Thailand, and in my mind I was sort of, I'll go to Japan. A lot of the books that I read, of course, were about Zen Buddhism. But as soon as I got to Thailand, and then it all sort of resonated for me, and I ended up staying. Would you say more about the ardent, purifying aspect of mindfulness? Well, one of the things that when we use the word ardency, then we're talking about effort. And then when we think about effort, then we want to be bringing it back into the context of how the Buddha defined right effort. So right effort was never about, say, how much you do, how quick you do it, how good it looks on the outside. it's more about the internal qualities that are being fostered, so that, and we chanted that in the Eightfold Path, and it's like whatever effort that we make for the, say, the releasing, relinquishing, abandoning unwholesome mental states that have already arisen, then that's right effort. So there's when we're putting forth effort to abandon, we see something's unwholesome, it's unskillful, and we're willing to put forth the effort to abandon, to give up. So there's that willingness to do that is there's a certain ardency, and it's a purifying quality. Whatever effort we make for the preventing of unwholesome qualities, unwholesome mental states from arising, say the unarisen unwholesome states, preventing them from arising, there's an effort that's there, that ardency is there, to head them off of the pass. Okay, been there, done that, I've seen this, okay, I don't need to go there. So that's a right effort there, and so it has a purifying quality to the heart. And the effort to bring into being wholesome qualities, wholesome mental states that have yet to arise, and that willingness to be proactive in lifting up wholesome qualities into the mind. And there's an ardency, there's an effort, and it has a purifying effect. And the effort to maintain wholesome qualities that have arisen, so one recognizes, oh, you know, this is really wholesome, this is skillful, this is good, this is in line with Dhamma. How to nurture that, how to protect it, how to care for it. So there's an ardency, and that's a purifying effect on the mind. So that sense of mindfulness is alert to the quality of the mind, and then it's adjusting its effort or its energy accordingly. was this question, did the Buddha give instructions for walking meditation? There's the actual instructions for walking meditation are extremely sparse. It's more like there is mentioned all over the place of the Buddha himself doing walking meditation, encouraging the monks to do walking meditation, or the Buddha going to, the Buddha going, seeing monks doing walking meditation, other wanderers of other sects seeing monks doing walking meditation. So there's lots of mention of walking meditation, but there's not a whole lot of instruction other than walking back and forth. So the instructions have come over time in more, say, later texts and later commentaries, and developed in that way. Yes. Yeah, and that's actually, Ajahn Siddhanta makes a really good point in saying that there's lots of mention of the, say, cultivation of mindfulness, cultivation of the practices, using the four postures. So sitting, walking, standing, lying down. These four postures are part of the cultivation of mindfulness. Mindfulness, clear comprehension, effort. There's lots of mention of all the four postures kind of equally. It's a nice little picture of somebody sitting in a, can I meet you in Hawaii? Okay, what is the latest news re women's ordination in Thai forest tradition from upper, lower echelons of the tradition? How would you advise young women seeking ordination in this kind of tradition? One is to recognize that the Thai forest tradition is completely outside of the echelons of the tradition. They're a tiny minority within the overall structure of the, say, of the Buddhist hierarchy, Buddhist. I think for here in the West, people have contact with, say, Thai forest tradition and think, whoa, that's Buddhism in Thailand, and it's really a tiny minority. And there's a very studied distance that they have from the kind of the echelons of power and decision making. So and in Thailand there are a few places that there are, and it's still very small, a few places where say women's ordination is taking place. Up in Chiang Mai is probably the most active. And that's in the north, and northeast is where the most of the Thai forest tradition is. And northeast Thailand is very, very conservative, so nothing much happening there. And so there are on the outskirts of Bangkok, there's I think the most active is up in the north. But then, I think here in the West, there's more scope for experimenting. There's more scope for training, places being set up. Although I haven't been to the places up in the north. And I mean, I would definitely advise the places that are starting to be established here, here in the West, here in America, here in California. Regarding the second foundation of mindfulness, feeling, there's two questions. One, is pleasant / painful functionally wanting / not wanting? No, the wanting not pleasant and painful is your kind of a root feeling tone of experience, and it hasn't formulated anything. The wanting not wanting is not feeling or vedana. That is the, say, a mental formation. That is a sankhara. So that wanting not wanting grow out of a feeling, but they're the kind of that bare sensation of pleasant, painful is a very simple tone of experience, and it hasn't formulated itself into anything yet. We do that after. And regarding unworldly or spiritual feelings, would you talk about what pleasant, painful, neither look like? Is there guidance or examples to help practice? I mean, one of the things is looking at that in terms of what arises from the feeling, so that there are, say, feelings that the mind moves toward the world, and say unworldly spiritual feelings are, say, those, and whether it's pleasant, painful, or neither, and neutral, it forms the basis of relinquishment or renunciation. So that's where the difference is, where the other, say a feeling associated with a worldly object, the mind moves toward it, and likes it, it dislikes it, it wants to get involved in it in some way. And whereas the, say, unworldly base of feeling is one that leads to relinquishment. Going on alms round, especially in the U.S., seems like a very noble, patient practice. Would you speak more of what happened when monastics go for alms the first time in an American town like Ukiah or Oregon, and when people have no idea what you're doing and you can't ask for anything, what happens? Did the monastics go hungry the first few times? Do you explain to people? Do you bless everyone that gives you food with a chant? I guess I'm just looking for an experience of faith and miracles. Of course, we started going alms round quite a few years ago in Ukiah. We waited. When we first arrived at Abayagiri, we didn't start going alms round right at the get-go. We waited until we had our change of use permit. We weren't going to jeopardize. We weren't quite sure what would happen. So we wanted to make sure that we had the legal basis for living there. But then once we got that, that took about three and a half years, and then we started going. And the very when we first started going, it was like walking through town, and of course it's quite a ways to Ukiah, so drive in. We first started going, the van would take us in, drop us off. The van could go off and do different chores or purchases or do different monastery business and come back and pick us up later, because nothing much happened. Now the van has to be really close by, because there's just constant offerings, constant food, and we can't carry it all. And there's lots of times when we can't even fit it into the van, all of it. It's really amazing. But it's grown slowly, and now it's very well established. But remember it's very organic, because going on alms round, you're not allowed to ask. People ask, and you can explain, because oftentimes what happens, people want to give you money. You think that you're asking for money, and they might want to give, and then you say, well, we don't accept money, but we accept offerings of food. What we're doing is we rely on the offerings of food to live for this day. So people, and some people say, oh, I don't have any food, and walk away. But then others sort of, light goes off. And say, oh, I've got this money, I can get some food. But I remember either the first time or one of the very first times that we went on alms round in Ukiah. I think it might have been the first time. And we had made an announcement, and one of the supporters of Abaya Giri from Redwood Valley. Was in town that day, saw us on alms round, got really excited. It was Laurel Mela. Got really excited, went into the bakery on State Street, and she was so excited. She started taking stuff and said, I've got to put food in the monk's bowl, so I'll be right back to pay. And she was this whole sort of kerfluffle. And the owner was there, and she was a witness. And anyway, she came back in to pay, and said, "What was that about again?" And so she explained about the monastery, and we live on offerings, and they were just on alms round, and then the owner said, "Oh, really? Can anybody do that?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, anybody. Could you invite the monks to come?" So then we started going to the bakery. And we did that for quite a few years. And she told the people who were working there, and whether she was there or not, then somebody would make an offering. And we do a blessing chant each day, and then we heard that the bakery was being sold, so it was sold, And we went, and we heard it was closed. No, it wasn't closed. It was it changed owners, but we hadn't. We heard it changed owners, so we didn't dare go in without an invitation from the owners. And so then there's several weeks where of course we didn't go in, and then finally. We're walking past. We'd already walked past the bakery, and one of the people came out, tracked us down, said, "You know, please come to the bakery. We've talked to the new owner and said we really miss you guys, because she kept the same staff. The new owners kept the same staff. So then they said, "What do we miss?" So then that's still the same. Say the local, what is it called now? Mamas or something. Mamas, yeah. So those were the new owners then, and they've been offering ever since. And it's a regular stop on Alms Round. And so it's quite very diverse. Some of the places that we go to are government offices. There's a government office of disabilities, there's restaurants, nail places, all sorts of, which is a really strange one. There's actually three, we go to three, yeah, but there's one that's particularly strange. It's very sweet. I mean, they're very generous, and very, very diverse. And then there's oftentimes there's spontaneous offerings, and of course, the Hermitage, Ajahn Siddhanto went up with a determination to go an alms round every day, so that make that a daily practice. And like we do at Abhaya Gira, we go on alms round once a week on the lunar observance days, which, because we're quite a ways out in the countryside, in order to get anywhere we need to go by car, so it's quite complicated. So Ajahn Siddhanto made a point of being close enough to a population that could walk. Of course, the early days that he was doing that, it was, I think they really impressed the townspeople, just these hardcore monks, because what was the elevation difference? It was over 2,000 feet. Huh? 16, okay. Anyway, they're up on a top of a ridge and then walk down the mountain, go into town, and go back up. So it's, I mean, if you, Ajahn Siddhanta was a very fast walker. It was, so it still is three hours. Other monks were, I remember Ajahn Yatiko going, he said, "Oh, that's really tough. It was 4 hours." But then now the Hermitage is closer. But it really got people's attention, and people really responded, and quite touching, really, how much generosity is shown. I think also nowadays there just is more knowledge or awareness of. Buddhism, monastics, maybe about 3 years ago, was it Ajahn Yaniko couple walked up about 3 years ago? About 3 years ago, they walked from Abhaya Gira up to the Hermitage, about 6 weeks, 2 months or something. That's just two monks, and so no money, no layperson, no, and they because you want to eat, so you go arms around every day. And they, there was only one day that they didn't get offerings. And it was because they miscalculated the distance from where they spent the night to the next town, because these towns are pretty sparse along that they walked along the coast, Northern California coast. I mean, things are spread out along there, so they miscalculated, and by the time they got to the town, it was after 1 o'clock. So they just had to keep walking. Do you understand impermanence as a phenomena of a river flowing, or as a light being turned on and off? Bhikkhu Nalayo's descriptions. I think limiting oneself to an either or understanding or image of impermanence is making it a bit too tight. Because it has a whole constellation, the word anicca. You have to come back to the Pali. It might sound, the English language is still, and it didn't. We're just trying to approximate, trying to get somewhere close to what the terms are, and so it's important to. Some of the basic terms are really good to understand what the Pali is, what the scriptural words are, and you don't need to be a Pali scholar to know this. Just these are sort of ordinary concepts that have a constellation of nuances of meaning. So the word anicca has impermanence. Is one thing. Change, inconstancy. Like Ajahn Jeff Trance said, because the word nicca means something that's constant. And so inconstant, something that's. As Ajahn Chah says, uncertain, not sure. So those are different ways of holding it. And they're all valid. You don't have to find one. Sort of meanings, and they all have a different nuance in terms of is it flowing in terms of change, or is it something discrete that's off and on? Well, it's all of that, and that's the reflection is being able to encompass the mind with familiarizing itself with that. Those qualities of uncertainty, of change, of impermanence, of inconstancy. So then the mind starts to, because you're using those as a means of fostering clarity and relinquishing, letting go. Okay, when I watch my breath, I have all I can do to be aware of one breath and then the next. But the Buddha said, know if it is long or short. Can you give an insight into why this step beyond bare awareness? Also, why long and short versus, for example, shaky and smooth, consistent, inconsistent, belly breath or nostril breath? Well, I think one of the things is that you take the breath as your first kind of anchor, and then you start to refine that attention. And as you refine that attention, then there's more texture to what one's experiencing. Start to notice different texts. And as the mind does become more more settled, more clear, then you actually need to pay attention to a bit more detail or a bit more of a framework, because if there's not much for the mind to do, then it'll drift off, or it'll start to it'll get bored, and then it either starts to fantasize about something else, or it starts to drift to into some kind of dullness. So that the mind, one needs to be balancing the mind. And certainly, right at the very beginning, when mindfulness is not so strong, not so sharp, then just the awareness of an in-breath and an out-breath is enough to engage attention. But as it settles, then we need to be applying a certain refinement of attention, so that the mind is able to keep up with a clarity that will start to be able to develop a tranquility and a peace within the mind. So that's a good point to end.